Good evening, everybody. Welcome to your Wednesday Night Live with Stefan Molyneux from Free Domain. Thank you for your patience as we're getting started. You know the general routine, freedomain.com/donate to help out the show. Would really hugely, deeply, humbly appreciate it. And I think afterwards, after this live stream, if you're a subscriber, you can join us. We're going to log in and watch the Sam Hyde show. God, I did that back in January. Bro takes his time to get things up and running. But nonetheless, it is in fact up and running. And is there one? Sorry, there's just one other thing that I need to get a hold of. It should be, oh yeah, no, that's up there. Yeah, we're good. All right. So that's good. So if you have questions, comments, issues, challenges, problems, criticisms, whatever you like, whatever is on your mind, I'm thrilled beyond measure to have to hold and to hear. We love you, Steph, says Andy. Thank you for all you do. Just brought a couple of physical books, copies of your book, Peaceful Parenting. Absolutely amazing. I plan to give them to my millennial friends. Fantastic. Thank you. Could I do a movie review of Dead Poets Society? Did I? So first thing you want to do is go to fdpodcast.com. That's for Free Domain Podcast.com, and don't tell me what the poets are doing. Yeah, you know what? I will do a review of Dead Poets Society. I like that movie. I thought it was good. So I will do a review of that. Good evening. And we have a caller. Oh, maybe even more than one, but let's start. I have topics, but we have callers, even better. Yes, if you want to unmute, I'm all ears.
Hey, Steph, how's it going?
Good, how you doing?
Good. So I have a question sort of in relation to the is-ought dichotomy and how that might apply to Bitcoin. So obviously it's an inanimate chunk of code. So I guess in that sense, it wouldn't have an ought. But I guess we do know that Satoshi had some sort of philosophy in mind when he was creating it. And I guess so in that sense, can we derive any ought from that? And I can go into kind of how this came to mind for me, or if you want to start there.
Whatever you like, man. Whatever you feel like chatting about. Go for it.
Yeah, I guess I'll give you a little more context. So I've been chatting, I chat with a lot of Bitcoiners, and I just noticed in like a newer class of Bitcoiners, they feel like there's no sort of moral direction or ethos of Bitcoin, and that it's just for me to use as a way to avoid inflation, or just a tool for me to use as a privacy mechanism. And there's no sort of drive for a greater moral purpose behind it, to obviously to rid the world of the evils of central banking, and that's all just sort of a collective moralized psyop, I guess you could say, and that Bitcoin, the saying is Bitcoin doesn't care, and it's sort of just an amoral blob. I see it as really sort of a revolutionary tool that it needs to be used that way, and for it to be ignored is sort of apathetic and lazy. So I don't know if that's just, you know, my perception, or is there a moral deficiency in not wanting to use Bitcoin to change the world? Or is it use it however you want?
Yeah, it is absolutely the most foundational moral engine outside of parenting to change the world. Of course, peaceful parenting has you lose before you win. Philosophy, virtue, morality always has you lose before you win. You know, just like if you get your ass off the couch, wipe the Cheeto dust off your nipples, and go and start working out, you're going to feel a whole lot worse before you feel better. Same thing with dieting, just about everything, you know. I remember seeing this video of the late singer Prince was talking about how, you know, people play Guitar Hero and they think it's fun. It's like, how about learning the actual guitar? But people don't have much capacity. He said, you know, learning the guitar is frustrating. It's frustrating. And, you know, but he stuck with it, obviously pushed through it. And that frustration is the price you pay. I found 20 years of floundering around with philosophy before I really started to get some traction. It sucks a lot. Imagine doing something for 20 years before making any particular progress of your own. Like, philosophy is the most brutal thing around, because there's so much to learn, so much to absorb, so much to understand, that I was, you know, 15 to 35, man, I'm in the frickin' trenches. Just trying to learn, trying to understand, trying to add some things, finding they fall over. It was just this endless game of playing Jenga blocks in a frickin' earthquake and fighting like crazy with friends' parents, with my parents, with siblings, with professors in university. And like, I graduated, or I got my marks for my master's degree, I think 6 months after everyone else, because they were fighting over whether what I had written was either madness, idiocy, or genius. They eventually went with genius, but it was quite a fight. And that's sort of been the history. And so 20 years of fight. Now, for things to improve in the world, and, you know, settle in, folks, this is going to be a wee bit of a rant. So for things to get better in the world, we have to evaporate the power of the uber class, the top class. Who are the top class? What is the top class? Well, if you've ever been heavily in debt, you know when you're heavily in debt, you're kind of a slave. Your time is not your own. You work for other people. And it's brutal. It's brutal. You know, you get a sudden bill. Let's say you make $100 an hour, right? You get a sudden bill for $1,000, you know, all other things being equal. Then you got to work to pay that bill for 10 hours. Make 50 bucks an hour, 20 hours, 20 bucks an hour, 50 hours, 10 bucks an hour, 100 hours. You get the math, right? So why don't things change in the West? People have been voting for and begging for, say, less immigration for decades. I mean, Brexit was about less immigration. And what did the British people get punished with? Much more immigration. So why? Well, because we look at the people that we vote for and we say, aha, they're in charge. False, they're not in charge. Not even close. There's layers above them that we don't even really see. And the people with the most power are invisible to the vast majority of people. And we can only see them in our mind's eye, or occasionally, you know, jabbing their fingers into Prince Charles's chest. So let's use Elbonia. That was a fictional country. Scott Adams, RIP, came up with. And Elbonia is $1 trillion in debt. Now, someone comes into power, is voted into power in Elbonia and says, I want to change, maybe it's immigration, maybe it's wants to privatize education, wants to change something foundational in the society. And what happens? What happens? Well, he says, I'm voting for change. And you can see this has happened in Italy, it's happened in Spain, it's happened in England, it's happened in a bunch of places. People say, we want change. And then they vote people in, and the prime minister of Elbonia says, by God, I'm going to enact change. Maybe he's going to cut immigration by 80% or 90% or cut it entirely. Well, then what happens? What happens? Well, of course, he gets a visit. He gets a encrypted communication and so on. And it says something like, hey, Mr. President of Elbonia, if you enact these policies, well, your entire economy is going to crater because we are going to stop lending you money. And we're actually going to ask you to repay some money. You know, thinking, there's a great TV show, The Sopranos, not a great show, but good acting and interesting stories. And there's a guy who runs a sporting goods store, and he gets into debt to the mafia. And then the mafia come in, and they start writing checks, and they start getting refunds, and they just pillage and hollow out his business. And he says, hey, that's what we do. We move in. We're like a bunch of ants when you leave something sticky on the ground. Just come in and maw it up, chew it up. So you go into that sporting goods store, right, before it's hollowed out and burnt to the ground for insurance money. You go into that sporting goods store and you say, hey, Bob, here's the owner. He's the owner and the manager of the sporting goods store. So Bob's in charge. It's his store. No, it's not. It's the mafia's store. That's who owns it, because he's in debt up to his children's eyeballs and his wife's kidneys to the mafia. He's not running anything. Because the mafia will destroy his store if he doesn't let them do whatever they want. He's a figurehead. He's got about as much decision as to where the store goes as the little hood ornament on a car decides where the car goes. It's not turning the wheel. It's not hitting the gas. It's not hitting the brakes. It's not punching in the GPS. Not doing any of that stuff. You got your figureheads. And above the figureheads, various layers of we will burn your country to the ground if you don't do what we tell you to. Debt, unfunded liabilities, a greedy-ass population that forever and ever, amen, wants something for nothing. We want all these services. We don't want to pay the taxes. We want all of these goodies and these benefits. We don't want to pay the taxes. So what happens? The government can only pretend to add value by borrowing money and putting it into the economy, by printing money and putting it into the economy. You've probably seen on these buses or trains that say, this transit service is paid for by the government of XYZ. And it's like, no, it's not. The government has nothing. Governments have nothing. Other than weapons and the belief of the population. The state is a state of mind. So let's say I was president of Albania tomorrow. Hail to the chief. I'm president of Albania tomorrow, and I say, I want to change X, Y, or Z. And the powers that be don't want me to change X, Y, or Z. What do they say? We'll pull your funding. You can't pay your bills starting tomorrow. Oh, and also, by the way, we're cutting you off from the international monetary settlements. We're not lending you any money. We're not offering you any credit. And not only are we not going to give you more money to bribe the population with imaginary made-up currency, but we're also going to start calling in debts. We're going to sell your bonds. It's going to collapse your economy. Your people will be starving within 2 weeks. If they're lucky, it could be less than that. So that's what happens. This is why nothing can be done. Nothing can be done because of currency. Nothing can be done because governments have the power to create currency out of thin air. Like you go to the bank. You go to the bank and you say, hey, I want a half a million these days. I want $500,000. I want you to lend me $500,000 so I can buy this house. And the bank says, sure. And what do they do? They type $500,000 into your account and magically the money is created and you're now in debt to them for a quarter of a century. Imagine that. Imagine that. Just being able to type whatever you want into your own bank account. It's a heady power. It's a incredibly destructive power. It's a haunting power. And it's a eviscerating power. It's fundamentally a satanic power. The devil offers you something for nothing. And all of the fools in the world who are optimized to want something for nothing, which is why we have technology. I'm not going to your house, knocking on everyone's door to have this chat. I'm spreading it through technology. So yes, currency, control of currency, the ability. The sins of the fathers shall not be visited upon the children. When you die, your debt dies with you. Ah, but except for the eternal vampiric ghost of state power allows you to attach debt and unfunded liabilities to your offspring. And in America, children are born into $1.75 frickin' million dollars of debt and unfunded liabilities. Many times more than the taxes they will pay over the course of their life. Most people make 900,000, a million over the course of their life. They pay 50% of it in taxes. So 1.75 million is less than a third after taxes people are going to pay over the course of their life. Because the government doesn't use your tax revenue to spend, it uses it as collateral to borrow. And people, because they're greedy and they're willfully stupid, and the worst part, of course, is we all have to pay the price for people's willful stupidity. Like a friend of mine, when I was younger, we'd play Dungeons and Dragons when I was early mid-teens, and every now and then, in between slurping our hypoglycemic sugar bomb bottles of RC Cola, we'd order some greasy pizza from the cheapest pizza place that looks like it was rolled in its dough in Cenk Uygur's armpits, and we'd all kick in a couple of bucks. And I remember one time my friend, he had a coupon. He's like, "Yeah, I got a $4 coupon." That, and we had this big argument whether that was valid. Was it enough that he reduced the price of the pizza, or did he actually have to spend his own money? And we said, "Well, what if somebody else had a coupon there?" Well, they didn't have a coupon. So anyway, it was an interesting argument. But you can't make choices when you're in debt to the mob. You do what the mob says. And the mob gives you something for free. "Hey, you want to play poker with us, man? We'll extend your credit. Here you go. You can have your credit. You can play poker with us. It's going to be tasty. You want more? Hey, I don't advise it, but if you want more, we'll give you more. Boom, boom, boom." Suddenly you owe them $100,000 at 20% interest every third week. And you have no freedom. You have no freedom. Debt is the ultimate refusal to defer gratification. Debt is the ultimate in eating the future in order to gorge on the present. Debt is when you have just enough food stored up for the winter, and like a squat-nosed, trough-snuffling pig, you chew through it all in the first month, and then you have 5 months to go. Now you're in debt, now you require, now you're enslaved. And the leaders are just as enslaved as everybody else. Because the leaders can't do anything. Either somebody calls you up and says, "Oh, by the by, you remember that time you went to St. James Island and had that really incoherent party in that striped dais to Satan? Hey, remember that? Mr. Epstein said, 'Hey, come on over, man. Snort a line. Do some drugs. Have some drinks. This girl, she wants you, man. She wants you.'" Little electric eye, brr, 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 recording in the top. So either you got that, or they say, "Well, if you want to do an Albonia, President Steph, if you want to do an Albonia, what we don't want you to do, we're calling everything in. You got to pay us now." Now, you can either do what we tell you to do, or alternatively, let me just give you your other option, just so you truly sniff the satanic lay of the land. The other thing you can do is you can, and they'll be able to keep a straight face when they tell you this. "Hey, Steph, President Steph, here's the other thing you can do. Here's the other thing you can do. What you need to do is you need to go on TV and you need to reason with your population, you see. You need to say to your people, 'Hey, you know, I'm looking at the numbers, man. And for four generations now, you all have been living on borrowed time, borrowed money. You all have been selling off the souls of your children to foreign banksters in return for getting that sweet, sweet stimmy check in the here and now. You got your welfare, you got your old age pensions, you got your free health care, you got your EBD, you got everything. Everything. You get your social security checks for your children. If we can slap a label on their forehead like ADHD and drug them, you get an extra $600 a month. Where's that coming from? Not your taxes. Most people don't pay taxes. Most people consume, consume, consume like a Pac-Man. Wanga, wanga, wanga. Crushing up the nads of anybody slightly more successful or considerably more successful than they are. At some point, The rich look at the poor and says, I think we're going to treat you with about as much compassion and empathy as you've treated us. And then you get fascism or communism, and the poor go the way of the dodo. Four letters slightly arranged, off they go. So President Seif, just go on the TV and say to people, sorry, we're going to have to cut back. You're going to have to accept at least a 70% reduction in services, and you're going to have to pay more in taxes. Because we have a lot of debt. Oh, and by the way, all those unfunded liabilities, you know, because for 60, 70 years, every time the public sector unions want more and more, well, the politicians don't want to raise the taxes, so all they do is promise them retirement benefits down the road. Well, the end of the road has come, and it's a banana peel of vampiric blood, wherein the children are going to slip and get concussions and roll slowly down a hill in a windmill fashion like a Land Rover or the end of Thelma and Louise. This is how little you love your children, people. You sold them for cash. You sold them for snacks. You sold them for seed oils, carbs, bullshit, and sugar. You put them on the auction block. You unbelievable intergalactic, hyperdimensional, cosmic a-holes. You sold your kids. Remember how you said, oh, slavery's the worst thing ever. Okay, slavery's bad. Debt enslavement is even worse. You have sold your children off to the point where they can work for three lifetimes and not be able to pay the debt you have them born into. You've put them in debt in frickin' triplicate. Three and a half times or more. Because while they're paying all that debt off, the interest keeps accumulating. So you've put them in infinity debt. They cannot pay it off. And you did that. Why? Because you had sex with some retarded thug who didn't stick around to help you raise the kids, and now you just want sucking the giant fiat blood-soaked money teat of the infinite government sow. You want a free staff or want a free retirement? You wanted to take out more than you ever put in and consider yourself wealthy. And you sold your children to do it. And nobody, of course, is ever going to look back and say, yeah, we really believe that society cares about its children. Your children are the tampons by which you attempt to quit hemorrhaging money based on your infinity greed. And this is why the children rebel against the aged. And this is why we have these stories of vampires, right? The people in charge who eat the young and who are never seen in sunlight and who hide in the shadows. Well, these are the central bankers in many ways. So, yeah, President Steff of Albonia, if you want to do X, Y, or Z, which is actually what the population wants to do, well, clang, clang, clang. You can beat your tin cup on the bars of the cage. Doesn't let you out. The only way out is to go to your population and say, friends, Romans, Albonian countrymen, the bill is due. We got to accept massive reductions in services. Can't pay the pensions. Can't pay all the free health care. Can't pay it. It's not the children's fault that we voted ourselves into the ball sack of the mafia. It's not their fault. They weren't even around. They weren't even a glimmer in your granddaddy's eye when everybody made these decisions. And you know, all you parents who say to your kids, you got to take responsibility, and if you don't study for the test, you got to get an F. If you didn't do your homework, then you're going to get in trouble. You know, you got to take responsibility for the things that you do, kid. Well, how about you guys voted us into infinity debt? No, that doesn't count. What are you, crazy? That's not a thing. Forget it. It's sad. What are you going to do? You going to laugh or far grimmer things occur? Maybe they should. I don't know. That's why I don't do politics. It's not a place for debate anymore. So either you do what the bankers want you to do, or you have to go and reason with the population. Now, if you go to the population and say, sorry, your great-grandparents, your grandparents, your parents all tied you down and oiled you up so the bankers could have their way with you prison style. Sorry, wasn't my fault. I opposed it. And normally what we do, you know, when we run out of money is we'd go to war. We can't really go to war anymore because there's weapons of mass destruction and bioweapons and all kinds of nonsense. That means the leaders are going to get hit as well as the followers. So we can't really go to war. Oh, yeah. Do you remember when COVID happened? I'm going to remember that. So remember when COVID happened? COVID was a giant warning that says, oh, yeah, we can whip any population into a frenzy and they'll tear you apart. They are drones. Right? We drone at them, they turn into mechanized weapons, which we can then point at anyone. Oh, they're a dissenter, they're a vax denier, anti-vaxxer. And they'll just tear you apart. We got a bunch of zombies, remote control zombies. Propaganda will program them, and they will tear you apart. Just in case you were wondering, it's pretty much the same as it was in the 1930s or the 19-teens in Russia. And we got these drones. We got these drones of people who don't think, they consume, they greed, they eat, they have about as much common sense as your average houseplant, and they simply grow towards the light of the fiat currency sunrise, and they will just greedily consume everything without any thought for the future. But good luck. Go reason with them. Go reason with them. You know, zombie movies and central banking arose pretty much at the same time. Because there's an infection which dehumanizes people called greed. And like that scene at the end of Fargo when the William H. Macy character is being arrested and he's like, no, no, no. People, they don't want reality. They won't take any restriction on the spending. And if you say there's no money, they say, make it or we burn it all down, right? The central banking and the mob are two ends, top and bottom of the mafia sandwich that consumes your future. So the only way out is Bitcoin. The only way out. And the same technology that allows for Bitcoin and allows for what I do also allows for infinite surveillance, right? Because the only thing that limited surveillance in prior dictatorships was the human element, right? The need for people to review mail messages and to read people their rights and to go through their diaries. But now AI can go in and scoop and sniff through everything and find wrong thinkers and punish them and so on. So it's a Bitcoin or infinity dictatorship. So when people say, oh, Bitcoin is just kind of a cool way to make money, I mean, I'm not disagreeing with that. I'm not disagreeing with that, but that's like saying the Venus de Milo makes an excellent paperweight. I suppose technically it's true, but there's a little bit more to it than that. So tell me if that makes sense to you.
Yeah, absolutely. So basically, they're just as bad as, let's say, a liberal who wants to tax Elon Musk to pay for more government spending. If you're apathetic about the possibilities of Bitcoin, you're basically on the same level. You're not really taking any action to utilize it to change the world. So, and one other thing I'll say is, you mentioned the government has nothing. So when I hear the Bible verse of, you know, give Caesar what is Caesar, well, Caesar has nothing. So can't give Caesar nothing. It's sort of a loop there.
I think Brutus fulfilled that biblical pledge.
Yes.
The Boromir pencil cup holder. So,
true.
Yeah, I mean, the great thing, so there was this theory way back in the day, and the theory was that evil is just a form of ignorance. Evil is just people who don't know stuff, that if you knew stuff, you'd be virtuous. And this was an argument made by Socrates and Plato and others that, you know, give them the truth and the truth shall set them free. Give them the truth and the angels of illumination will dance behind their eyeballs, creating a John Travolta disco floor of knowledge and virtue and truth and blah, 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 blah. And spoiler, that's now been tested because everybody has like the infinity of human knowledge, right, in their ass. You've got the library of Aslandia, Alexandria, Aslandria. You've got the library of butt cheeks. You've got the crack of wisdom. You've got the back pocket of infinite truth. And you've got, if you put it in your front pocket, your balls are being radiated by infinity knowledge that anybody can look up anything at any time for any purpose and learn anything they want. And that's available to everyone. You don't even need a library card. You don't need to take a bus to get to the library. It's literally all the human knowledge is beamed into your groin. You are fertile with radioactive wisdom. And that's what's happened. And have people become better? Well, sure, some. But the beautiful thing about all of this is that those of us with the eyes to see, and I say this with some fairly roomy, squinty eyes to see, I mean, I didn't need glasses till my 40s, but yeah, I kind of need them now, but it's all right. I'm going to be 60 this year. That's not the end of the world. In fact, it's better than the alternative, right? It's better to have eyes that are squinty than eyes that are pure dust. But the reality is that those who have been given every opportunity to learn, who refuse to learn, the beauty of all of this, and I'm telling you, man, if you've not experienced this or understood this, you really, really need to grind this into your bone marrow, is that I have been doing philosophy for 45 years. I was 65, 15 to 65 would be half a century. That's a long ass time to do philosophy. And I will say this, that I've outlived a lot of philosophers throughout human history while being quite controversial in my own way. Actually, not in my own way, in just about every way. And the beautiful thing about the modern experiment of people being given Obamaphones and access to all the information in the known universe, real time, live, factual information, and they don't even have to read it. They can just put it on, listen to it. You don't have to watch what I'm doing. You don't have to be filled with the glory of my giant ostrich egg thumb forehead. You can just have it talk to you. You can have it read to you. You can look it up in AI. You can have AI teach you stuff, anything. And you can say, teach me economics in the style of Ludwig von Mises or Murray Rothbard or Hayek or whoever, right? Just teach me in the style of. And you can learn all of these things. Easy. Easy. And there's lots of unemployed people, so there's the neats, right? Not in education, employment, or training. Lots of time to learn anything now. If learning has become as easy as having a tailored, personalized, hyper-eloquent, customizable tutor, and people don't bother learning, frack 'em. Frack 'em. And that's the beauty of it, is that thinkers in the past, myself included, have always said, oh, if I put it the right way, if I find a way to communicate it in a way that's more palatable or more acceptable or more vivid or more elegant or more mellifluous or funnier or with more visual cues, or if I could just, with hand puppets, if I could write my thoughts on the aurora borealis, right? Aurora borealis. Aureoli borealis. Strangest porn name in history. But people have always said, myself included, in the past, like I wrote novels, I did role plays, I had people come up on stage to explain ethics, I did speeches everywhere and so on. And I'm like, well, if I could just find a way to communicate to people so that they could understand, and I put the onus upon myself to be a better communicator because, my God, I just need to get people to understand some basics. This is way back in like 20 years ago, I did a 17-part introduction to philosophy series. Did quite well before there was a giant smoking digital crater where my social media presence used to be. But the beautiful thing is, and I say this genuinely and deeply, you got to understand this. Not you, I'm sure you are, but the people as a whole. We don't have to care anymore about the people who refuse to learn. It's not on me. It's not on you. because especially with the rise of AI over like the last half decade and so on, you can get a personalized tutor to explain it to you at your pace. Your personalized tutor can come up with exam questions. It can come up with entertaining ways to teach you these things and so on, right? I tried to make philosophy as entertaining and consumable and digestible and actionable as possible over the last 20 plus years of being a public intellectual. And I think I did a really good job. I'm very, very happy and proud at what I did in the realm of philosophy. I say, well, but, you know, there's still a lot of people who reject philosophy. There's, you know, like still like 96, 97% of the audience didn't follow me one website over, and 97% of people never donate at freedomain.com/donate. So they don't really kind of get it. Like they'll pay for Netflix hyper-woke ideological brainstem programming, but they won't do $5 a month to a philosopher desperate to save the world who has the best communication skills of any philosopher in history. I mean, there's things I'm good at, things I'm not good at, that I'm good at. So the beautiful thing is that you and I and others are released from obligation to save people who won't lift one little finger to save themselves. You know, like you've come up with a cure for an illness and that people are dying from and they hate it. And it's a painful illness, expensive illness. You got a cure and you say, man, I even put sugar, I put candy in it. I'll have it delivered by Alvin, the singing chipmunk. I will put it between the cleavage of a hot nurse. Like you can just go in there, make motorboat noises and lick the pill out of her cleavage and go, mama. And you've made it as possible. And they don't want it. They don't want the medicine. And it's like, okay, well, then you don't make it. But I couldn't have done more to make the medicine easily available, palatable, and AI is even better in many ways, right? So,
yeah. And so they use it. All they do with it is read their Apple News feed about the reflection pool and get outraged about this crap.
I love how the reflection pool is actually the story of narcissists, right? I don't know if you know where the word narcissistic comes from. So there was an ancient divine or semi-divine being named Narcissus, and he was very good looking, and Narcissus looked over the edge of the water to get a drink and caught a reflection of himself in the water and said, oh yeah, that's I'm so handsome. I'm so good looking. Oh, I'm going to rub myself a little. I'm going to play with my earlobes a little bit. I'm going to steer myself back and forth a little bit. But I look at those lashes, that beautiful hair, those cheekbones, my perfect teeth. And he starves himself and dies and falls into the water and drowns because he's so in love with his own reflection. That's where narcissistic comes from. And so, yeah, the beautiful thing is, knowledge is a click away in ways that Socrates, who thought that evil and corruption was just a lack of knowledge, well, knowledge is a click away. For free, you can have a personalized tutor teach you anything you want at your own level. Let's say you're reading at a grade 7 level. Okay, well, explain central banking to me at the grade 7 level in the style of Murray Rothbard. Okay, boom, you're done. He's gonna step you through it. It's going to make sense. It's going to... So people who don't want to do that, the beautiful thing is like, okay, I no longer care about your future because you don't care about my future. You don't care about your future. Foundational principle in life, you cannot, not ever, ever, ever flourish, be happy, or stay sane by caring about people more than they care about themselves. Some guy's eating himself to death. You sit down, you say, hey man, I love you. You gotta not eat yourself to death. It's breaking my heart. It's really sad to see what's happening to you. And it's like, okay. Detach. De-frickin-tach. Cut the cord. Get out. Climb to the light. Get out of Plato's caves. So you tell people, here's what you need to do. Here's the truth. Here's the facts. Here's the reason. Here's the evidence. And here's how you learn it. And if they don't want to learn it, then I have no loyalty left to the bulk of humanity. Sorry, you were going to say?
Oh, I said bye. See you later.
Yeah, bye. Yeah, absolutely. It's been real, man. I'm sorry that you don't want a cure to the illness that you know you have. Everybody says, right? And politicians have completely given up. Like, you learn things about the world by everything that's not said, right? They don't talk about IQ, right? They don't talk about human biodiversity. And when was the last time in any political race of any kind that anyone ever talked about debt and unfunded liabilities. I mean, I remember 2016, like I was kind of into politics, 2020, and before that too. But, you know, 2016, I really did break down some pretty important falsehoods about Trump by the media. And Trump has never talked, to my knowledge, and maybe he's mentioned it once or twice, but nobody ever talks about the national debt, because you can't.
It'd just be Ron Paul, I guess, but he was pretty, didn't get that far.
Ron Paul. Yeah, absolutely. Dr. No, or as he's also called, Boromir. Ah, I will take political power and it will work. And he led. And I like Ron Paul as a person for sure. Guys, anyone who's delivered 6,000 babies is a human cannon of fertility and good for him. But he did draw libertarians away from peaceful parenting and into the death trap and roach motel of politics. So Boromir, for sure, as far as that goes. And again, with all good intentions and all of that, but people, libertarians, love talking about the non-aggression principle as long as it doesn't actually apply to anything in their own lives. So yeah, people can't talk about debt, because the moment you start talking about debt and unfunded liabilities, people don't want to hear about it. Just give me my free stuff. Fiat currency is the most addictive substance in the known universe, because individual addiction can only just destroy yourself and those around you, but fiat currency is actively destroying the entire planet. And that is the most dangerous addiction, and Bitcoin is the cure.
Amen.
All right. Well, thank you. I guess, appreciate that. Sorry, go ahead.
One quick thing. I've been getting pretty good explaining UPB, and I had a question. It's a quick question. So would insulting be, because you can't, if you want to be insulted, is it actually an insult?
Well, sure. I mean, not really. I mean, if you've ever gone to a comedy show, you know the people who sit at the front. If you have an interactive break the fourth wall comic, then the comic is going to make fun of them. He's going to, and I personally quite love being made fun of by comics. I think being made fun of is like a British thing, or maybe a bit of an Irish thing, not a German thing. I don't get it from my German side. But if you want to be insulted, is it really an insult? Like, come on. Like, when you get boxers, they're going to trash talk each other. It's just part of the show. Or the world wrestling guys with their heavily oiled elephantine muscles and strange heart diseases and early deaths, they will trash talk each other, and it's, you know, you can see them not even really being able to keep a straight face. So yeah, if you want to be insulted, it's not really an insult. Sorry, go ahead.
So then you can say that insulting is not UPB, right? Then,
well, hang on. So UPB deals with violence, the initiation of the use of force. How is insulting someone initiating the use of force?
Okay, I didn't realize it was only regarding force. Okay.
So there's aesthetically preferable behavior, which is things like being polite, diplomatic, and so on. And that those are nice to haves, but not essential. The reason being that you can avoid those things. So if I have a friend who constantly shows up an hour late, he's not imposing anything on me by force, because I can simply stop being friends with him, right? Or I can say, well, he's always an hour late, so I'll just show up an hour late or something like that. But if somebody, you know, jumps you in an alley and holds a knife to your throat, you can't just choose to not be part of that relationship. So UPB is about dealing with things that are imposed upon you by force, and aesthetically preferable behavior is good standards of interaction that are not imposed by force, because nobody can force you to stay friends with someone. Like I had a friend many years ago, who was kind of competitive with me. And there's no point competing with me, because in the things I'm not particularly good at, I don't bother competing. In the things that I am very good at, there's almost no point competing with me, because I'm just going to win. And so he wanted to compete with me. He viewed me as kind of an alpha male. He viewed himself as a bit of a beta. And so what happened is every time we were in a social situation, he would bring up silly or foolish things that I'd done, or would tell stories about mistakes that I'd made or whatever it is, you know. He was better at skiing than I was, because he grew up skiing and I was too broke to do skiing I went once in my teens, and then I got a bit more into skiing when I was in the business world. And he was a really good skier, no question. So then he'd say, oh yeah, but he fell there and then he fell there. And so every time we were in a social setting, he would attempt to score points by bringing up foolish or silly things that I did. And I talked to him about it, and I said, hey, man, you know, it's a bit repetitive. And, you know, I have a good sense of humor about myself, but this is starting to be a little pathological. Like, it's all one-sided. And it's just, you know, when you get that weird feeling when somebody's making fun of you because they care about you or they love you, or, you know, and it's just kind of a funny quirk, that's one thing. But when somebody starts to really dig in and they get a kind of tension and an insistence behind the words. And I said to him, like, I don't like it in particular. Like, you got to take a break. It doesn't really work for me. And so on. And we were both single guys at the time. And of course, I was fully aware that he was putting me down in the presence of eligible ladies so that he could maybe have a better shot at things with the women. And he wouldn't stop doing it. So I just stopped being his friend. He wasn't imposing anything on me by force at all. So UPB in its core is about the things you cannot escape, because violence can never be UPB. The initiation of force can never be UPB.
Right.
But nobody is violently imposing their will upon you if they insult you. If they insult you, then you can choose to not associate with them. And it's actually a passive action, right? To get away from violence is a positive action. Like, somebody holds a knife to your throat, you've got to wrestle them down, or you've got to bite them back, or whatever it is, and call for your girlfriend to help you out, or whatever it is you're going to do. Right? It's a positive action. But if, you know, when this guy would say, hey, let's go to this party Saturday, I'd say, nope. He's like, oh, you're so sucky about me putting you, like, making fun of you. Like, don't be so sensitive, man. I'm like, hey, you're just doing it again. I don't like it. I'm not happy with it. And you don't want to change. So go and enjoy the party. And I'd go and do something else. So when people are imposing their will upon you, but what they're imposing on you is not violent, it's zero effort to avoid. Like, if my friend who was always an hour late says, hey, let's meet down at Roy Thompson Hall and go and see a concert or something like that. And I say, no, because you're always late, we're going to miss the first half, blah, blah, blah. Like, I don't have to do anything. I could just sit home. Like, I literally have to do nothing to avoid things that are not imposed upon me by force, whereas things that are imposed upon me by force, I have to take strenuous, dangerous, risky efforts that could get me killed in order to avoid them. So as far as insults go, there is a level of insult that is UPB violation, though, and that is in the realm of slander or defamation, right? So
reputation.
Yeah, reputation, because reputation is an economic good that people work to get, just as much as they build a house, just as much as they save their money. You build your reputation. And so if people destroy your reputation, then they have cost you a significant amount of money. So, for instance, I generally do business on a handshake and so on, right? Now, and the reason that I do that is I trust people and they trust me, and I've been honorable in business. I've been an entrepreneur for like 30 years, and I'll always try to keep my word, or if for some reason I can't, I'll let them know ahead of time and tell how I'm going to make restitution up and things like that. And so not having to involve a lot of lawyers and contracts and accountants and so on, it saves a lot of money. It's a, you know, it's like 10% less per deal or whatever it is, right? Now, if somebody lies about me and says, oh, Steph cheated me and so on, right? Then people are going to be more wary about doing business with me, and it's going to cost me 10% more, and some deals I won't even get, right? So reputation is a tangible asset that you gain by positive behavior, in the same way that good health is a positive value you gain by eating well and exercising and so on, and being lucky to some degree. And so if somebody poisons you, then they're taking all of your hard-earned effort and undoing it because they're harming your health. And if somebody harms your reputation, they're taking all your hard-earned effort, and where it has caused economic harm, that's unfair competition. So if you've got two restaurants, the Chinese restaurant and the Italian restaurant, and the Chinese restaurant guy says, oh, there was a dead rat in the rigatoni at the Italian restaurant, or rat droppings or something like that, and it wasn't true, then people would be like, ooh, I don't really want to go for rat droppings. So I guess I'll go, let's eat Chinese, right? Because at least then the rats are clear and on the menu. You can order them. They don't come in by surprise, right? You get a little tail coming out of the spaghetti. And so if the Chinese restaurant owner lies about the food at the Italian restaurant, he's cost the guy hundreds of thousands of dollars or more in a business. And that is theft. That is the destruction of a shored up and hard-earned reputation for cleanliness and good health in the food. And so, yeah, that kind of stuff is actionable. But, you know, if you say, I think Bob is an a-hole, okay, well, whatever, right? That's not the end of the world. But if you say, Bob is a murderer, right? Well, that's going to spread around and that's going to be, it's going to interfere with his dating prospects, it's going to interfere with his business prospects, his hiring prospects, his borrowing prospects. People aren't going to want to sign leases with him. He's going to have trouble renting a house or an apartment and a car. And so that just massive harm. And so I think Walter Block says you can't own the contents of other people's minds, and therefore copyright and defamation and so on is unfair. It's not valid. I don't agree with that. And he's got tenure, so what does he care about reputation? But I, of course, have been subject to massive reputational attacks. And of course, I've worked very hard over my life to have a good reputation. And then the reputational attacks, I mean, they're very effective. They work because people don't have time to investigate every claim. And people say, well, where there's smoke, there's fire. Or in general, people say, well, Steph must have done something to piss off some pretty powerful people. So maybe I'll just not donate to him or spend time on his show because, you know, he's being, you know, if he's being hunted by the mafia, I don't want to catch a stray, so to speak, right? So I think that there are some exceptions with regards to insults, but yeah, in general, insults are a voluntary part of a relationship that's never imposed on you by force. Does that make sense?
Yes, I really appreciate it. And thanks for chatting.
You're very welcome. I appreciate the questions. Thank you for triggering ye old fun, positive, ranty planet. All right. Monsieur N. Sorry, somebody's asked, hope you're doing well. Any chance to re-upload the old channel's back catalog of videos? There is. In fact, you can get at FD for free domain, fdpodcasts.com, fdpodcasts.com. You can just do a search for whatever old show you liked, and the video will be there almost for certain. So yeah, just click on the show you want to do the truth about. McCarthyism, the truth about Joseph McCarthy, the truth about George Washington, the truth about Abraham Lincoln, the history of the Roman Empire. You can do all of those videos. Just do a search, click on the show, and below will be the video link. As far as getting them all back up onto YouTube, I don't know, man. I don't know. We'll see. Noble? End something there? What is that? Notable? Nobre. Nobre. If you want to unmute, I'm all ears.
Hi, Seb. Can you hear me?
Gotcha.
Okay. I think I joined a few minutes ago, so you may have already answered this. But in terms of, like, I think, I'm not sure if this, like, goes into, like, reputational damage, but, like, for example, I think a week or two ago, there was a young man who pretty much said he would work with a certain ethnic group. And I guess since then, I think the Department of Justice and other people have pretty much tried to make it so he can no longer find work, or make it very difficult for him to find work. I guess my question is, when it comes to that sort of stuff where people try to make it so you cannot have gainful employment, I guess you can dip with this. Is this like a form of trying to kill you or starve you?
Yeah, I mean, so in America, more than 90% of the jobs created over the last 5 or 6 years went to women. And why is that? Because there's a massive push to hire women, and there's no upper end, right? It's not like, oh, we've got to 50%, now we've got to balance things out. So the left in general represents those who believe they need force in order to correct an injustice. So women, for instance, will generally vote for the left, especially young single women or single women of any age, will vote for the left because the left will force businesses to hire women. And the women don't believe that they can be hired if they're not forced to be hired. And this is true of a wide variety of groups of people and so on. They say, well, damn it, we can't really compete in the free market because of prejudice or sexism or whatever it is. And so we need the government to force people to give us jobs and pay us more and so on. And of course, that does come at the expense of others. And this sort of big melting pot, which is a phrase coined by a leftist. But the big melting pot idea is that, you know, everyone comes in and we all just share different foods and we have wonderful markets with lots of different kebabs and so on. But it's not sold as, oh, yeah, by the way, if you're a white male, it's going to be really, really hard for you to get a job. And that's just the standard depopulation agenda as a whole, which is that if young men are discouraged or prevented in many ways from getting jobs. I mean, we know what happens when women get a lot of money. They spend a lot of money, right? They go into debt. They buy things. They travel. When men get a lot of money, they tend to save it and form families. Women who get a lot of money will often leave their families. Men who get a lot of money will generally found families. So if you want fewer families and less reproduction, then you have a massive process in the state and the government of transferring as much wealth as humanly possible from men to women. And that is what lowers the birth rate in general. And so, you know, I can't say it's an attempt to murder or anything like that. It is wrong. A forced association is a violation of freedom of association. Forcing people to hire other people is in the same moral category as forcing women to marry men or forcing men to marry women. Like arranged marriages under power of compulsion, we would consider to be a great evil, as indeed it would be. And whether it's economic intercourse, social intercourse, or intercourse, people should not be forced into non-consensual relationships. I mean, it seems a weird thing to have to say, but we should not force people into non-consensual relationships, whether they're sexual, platonic, social, or economic. You should not be forced to hire people. You should not be forced to have quotas. It should be a raw meritocracy. And for a variety of reasons we've talked about over the years, probably a little bit to death, that is anathema to some people. So that's what's going on. The vast majority of jobs are going to people new to the country. The vast majority of jobs are going to women. And the result in the birth rate is clear. So I hope that makes sense.
No, that makes perfect sense. I work with a lot of women and, you know, the more money it seems like they make, if I work in the medical industry, it seems like the higher position that they have, the more debt it seems like they seem to find themselves in. So that's been my experience.
Well, and men will date horizontally and down, and women will only date up. Again, in general, blah, blah, blah. But this is, you know, hypergamy 101, that women want the wage gap eliminated and want a man who makes more money. Now, how they hold this double think together without their heads exploding, scanner style, is utterly beyond me. But if women want to make as much as men, then half the men are taken out of the dating pool for them, at least. And they usually want a man who makes quite a bit more than them. So if, you know, to take some very broad numbers, if a woman wants a man who makes 25% more than her, then her dating pool is 25% of men. And the problem is, in the converse, if 25% of men can date just about all the women, they're not going to settle down because they're too busy being bed-bouncing playboys, right? So when you have an infinite conveyor belt of hoochie-coochie coming your way, it's pretty tough to stop, turn off the machine, and take one home forever and ever. Amen. So it is, it's really tragic. I mean, I talked about this, gosh, not to, this woman's not to blame for all of my more controversial opinions, but Janice Heimlich, who was actually daughter of the doctor who created the Heimlich maneuver, we talked about this like 15 years ago, that when women get more education and they get more income, it does not undo hypergamy, which is their desire to date a man with equivalent or greater education and greater income. Women are hardwired to go for men with greater income because women, for most of human history, were disabled with childbirth, at least economically disabled. I mean, they got to continue the species, which was obviously a big plus. But economically, they were largely disabled by endless pregnancies, childbirth, breastfeeding, and then they graduated from having children growing up to having grandchildren, and they just start the whole groundhog day of infinite fertility all over again. And so women are drawn to men with good genes and a lot of resources. And as women get more and more resources, the pool of men that they're willing to date and settle down with gets smaller and smaller. But because men tend to be more promiscuous if given the opportunity than women, as more and more women are chasing fewer and fewer men, fewer and fewer men want to settle down because you've just, hey, this one doesn't work out. There's another hot girl coming down the pipe and another hot girl going down the pipe. And listen, I mean, I'm obviously not going to call myself some big, giant, egg-shaped stud muffin, but I will say that I never really had any trouble getting dates, particularly when I got into my 30s. I mean, it was very easy because there were lots of women around who wanted to date, but they didn't know how to add value. Because women have been psyoped into thinking that what they want in a man is what a man wants in them. So I want an ambitious, hard-driving, successful, big-income guy, right? And it's like, but that's not what men are looking for. That's not what men are looking for. It's sort of like saying, well, men like vaginas. So I should like vaginas. It's like, well, but if you like vaginas and you're a woman, then you're a lesbian or gay, and you're kind of out of the pool. Men want women to not be like men. I don't know why this needs to be said. Men want women to not be like men. Because if you want someone that you want to have sex with to be like a man, you're gay. So women have got this weird thing where they, well, this is what I would admire in a man, hard driving and not domesticated and you know, they've got this caricature of masculinity, like that men just, you know, thump the table and demand things. So the women go around, well, this is what's attractive to me, or this is what men are, so this is what's attractive. So I'm going to thump the table and demand things. I'm not going to be domesticated. I'm not going to be feminine. I'm not going to be at all submissive about anything. And then they're surprised when the relationships turn into gay relationships as a whole. Right, you look at the promiscuity in the gay community, there's tons of exceptions. So you look at the promiscuity in the gay community, it's off the charts. I mean, when I went to theater school, also when I was in my master's degree, I lived in a house with four gay guys and a lesbian. And the stories I heard and the things that I saw would make Freddie Mercury in his dung sex dungeon blush and faint. And so what happens is by acting like men, women provoke promiscuity in men, and then the women complain that men are just trash who won't commit. And it's like, well, we're happy to commit, but you kind of got to be feminine. And the more masculine the man, the more feminine a woman he wants. That's natural because we all seek for balance in these kinds of things. And so, I mean, I was dating a lot in my teens and 20s and 30s and all of that. And then, as I said before, I met my wife and the woman who became my wife, and shocking, like I was in my 30s, right? And we had agreed to go somewhere, and I said, can we do it later? Because I have to go downtown and I have to pick up my sandals. I got them repaired. Why did I get them repaired? Because I'm cheap. I am a flock of tiny birds. I am cheap, cheap, cheap. But, and my wife was like, I'm downtown. I can pick them up for you. Swear to God, my jaw hit the floor. And like this giant egg of isolation and exploitation opened within me, and I was never the same since. Since that moment, I still remember the day. I still even remember the time of day, but my life completely changed. And after dating, doesn't really matter how many women, but not zero, a woman was like, I'll be downtown. I can get that for you. I can't tell you what a freight train pileup, short circuit, lightning striking powder keg, world destroying, past life exercising moment that was in my life. Like, wow. She's do I have this right? She's going to do me a favor. Open-heartedly, happily, no problem, thrilled to help. And I was like, well, we're getting married. And it's 24 years ago. And, you know, we're still joyfully married and have a wonderful time. And there's nothing I won't do for her, and there's nothing she won't do for me. But women have become kind of balky, and because they believe that they're so exploited by the patriarchy that being nice to the patriarchy is like sleeping with the enemy. And she's taught me a lot about generosity, because I've been so exploited by women, and this is, men don't really talk about this too much, but I was so exploited by women that I just figured that was the price of dating, was you just get exploited. Like women just, you do stuff for women and they get very tense and balky and negative about doing things back. You know, there's a, oh gosh, what was her name? Things Our Mothers Never Taught Us or something, Danielle, someone or other. It's a book I read before I got married. And she was telling a story about how she and her husband were playing tennis with another couple, I think it was. And the husband was lacing up his shoes and his wife was just coming over from the clubhouse. And he said, oh, I forgot my tennis racket in the clubhouse. Could you grab it for me? And she's like, hey, you forgot it. You go get it.
Oh my God.
I once was heavily involved with a woman who wanted to get into the arts. I wrote her a movie. I funded the movie. I produced the movie. And then I asked her to read one of my books and she's like, I don't really feel like you've motivated me to. And I'm just like, oh my God, I just made a whole movie for you. You can't read one of my novels? Crazy. Crazy. And I mean, if you're a man, you know what I'm talking about. And listen, I mean, women have been psyoped and women are score much higher in the big five personality trait called agreeableness. So they kind of want to get along and they don't ask what's true. They ask what's approved of. And in general, right? Tons of exceptions, but in general. And so just meeting a woman who was happy to contribute and help was like, I will give you both my kidneys. I will give you anything under sun and moon. And I have worked very hard for my family over the last quarter century. And she's worked hard too. My God, does she ever work hard? And we both wake up in the morning thinking about how we can make life in the world better for each other and our daughter and all of that. And man, she's taught me a lot. Oh my God, she's an amazing, amazing person. Or you could just say a typical woman from 60 years ago, although I wouldn't think of her as typical at all, because she was typical, atypical in that she escaped propaganda. But just be helpful, be of service, be useful. I mean, have you had women, I'll ask this to the men, right? Have you had women who think a lot about how to make your life better and easier? Have you had women who work hard to make your life better and easier? One! One! I have known one over the course of my life. Adults, right? My daughter does that as well. My daughter does that as well, but sorry for the long speech. I hope that helps. Does that answer any of your questions or anything you wanted to know about?
Yeah, I mean, that's not where I thought it would go, but it ended up being exactly what I needed to hear. That is, my experience has been, I mean, the exact same. Like, it's unfortunate, like, you know, fortunately or unfortunately, I've worked, just due to the nature of my job, I've worked with a lot of women and they talk about their dating, you know, horror stories. And it always comes down to what you describe, like this, a lot of them, you know, doctors and things like this, they're making an upwards of 200,000 and up. And, you know, they're looking for someone who makes more than them, but they also don't want to like bring feminine qualities to their relationships. And when I think about my mother and, you know, and all the women in my, you know, old life, yeah, it's, I almost teared up hearing you say, like, you know, your story about your wife, about like, just, you know, because that's true. Like us men, it's just, we don't. Yeah. When we hear these things, like, I'll do something for you. Yeah. That's, oh yeah, I'm already there. I'll do that for you. It's like, oh, my heart. Oh yes. So yes. Thank you, Stefan. I really appreciate that.
You're welcome. And here's a funny thing too. You're sort of talking about women who want successful men who make money, right? Okay. So what are successful men who make money all have in common is that they know how to negotiate value, right? So a doctor, you say, makes $200,000 a year. Okay, well, a doctor makes $200,000 a year because he knows he's worth $200,000 a year and he's going to negotiate for it. I mean, I very much enjoyed the process of negotiating when I was in the business world. I think it's very interesting because negotiation isn't just, you know, well, you say 100, I say 50, we meet at 75, right? Negotiation is trying to find ways that's win-win, which is not obvious, right? So I won't sort of get into detail. So negotiation is very interesting. It's a complex and creative process. And when you hit that sweet spot where you come up with a solution or the other person comes up with a solution, that's better than anything you've ever thought of. I mean, it's bliss. It's joy. I mean, I do negotiations with all my call-in shows. I'm just negotiating with the people who want the caller to continue to believe lies and with philosophy and truth and so on. And so the one thing that's very true about the men that women want is we know how to negotiate for value. And what that means is that, let's say the woman wants kids. Okay. So you've got a woman who makes $150,000 and a man who makes $200,000. He knows the value that he's bringing. And he knows that he's bringing value, and he knows that the other person has to bring value, which is why you don't have doctors who work for minimum wage, because they ask for more because they know they bring value. So they demand and require value in their relationships. And so that's what women want. They want the guys who can negotiate to get value. And then they expect that in the most important decision that a man will ever make in his life, which is who to marry, the man is going to completely cast aside any conception of negotiating for value. And that's wild to me. That's why I didn't settle down before. I came close once, was engaged once, and I was just like, I don't get how this serves me. Because in the business world, I'm like, hey, I want to serve you, but you know, I want you to serve me too. We got to have win-win. That's why I was reasonably successful and as an entrepreneur in the software field and so on, right? I traveled, I negotiated, I dealt with difficult and unhappy and aggressive customers. I once had to talk a customer out of suing our company for various reasons. And so you learn to negotiate. You learn to exchange value for value. And then these women who are like, well, I really want this guy who can negotiate hard for equal value, but I'm not going to offer him equal value. Because what does a man want? Why do we make all this money? Men who make money. Why do we make money? Freedomain.com/donate. Why do we make money if we make money? To pay for families. That's why men have all this testosterone, this size, this strength, this concentration ability, this semi-autistic focus on a singular goal, and so on. And I saw this when I managed men and I managed women. I hired and managed men, hired and managed women. Men's productivity was off the charts. Women were sort of slow and steady and they got the job done, but men's productivity was wild compared to women. And why do we have all this extra productivity? Because 90% of her income goes to a wife and kids. We live on table scraps. We sleep wrapped around the chimney in a storm while the wife and kids are comfortable downstairs. Whatever the kids spill off the table, we go and snort it up for our nutrition. So yeah, we make money to pay for a wife and kids. And so if you're someone who makes 200 grand a year and some woman makes 150 grand a year in some, what do they call it, made up daycare jobs so that women don't have children. But there's someone, it's highly subsidized to put it mildly, right? So she makes 150. And if you're an ambitious, high testosterone, hard negotiating, successful man, you want to have kids. You want to have kids because what's the point of all this money? Because hedonism runs out of steam in your 30s because the hedonic treadmill, right? You just get used to everything, right? And so the man looks at the woman and he says, oh, you make 150. Okay. But you don't really. Why? Because I want to have three kids, right? Three kids, 2 years apart, year and a half of breastfeeding, recovery. And you got to get them to the age of five, right? So 2, 4, 6, last one's got to get to at least the age of 5 to get to school. That's 11 years out of the workforce. So your 1.65 million that you're imagining you're bringing to the table, you're not bringing to the table. You're just not, if I want kids. Or if you say, well, no, I'm an American woman. I'm going to go back to work 4 to 6 business days after giving birth. Oh, whatever, like a month or two. Okay. Well, then all we do is we take a good chunk of your salary and we hand it over to some Guyanese woman in a daycare to raise our kids in her values, not ours. That's not what I'm working for. I don't want my kids growing up knowing all of the intimate details of Senegalese dance and kebabs. I want them to be raised in my values, my thought process, Western traditions, if you're Western, whatever, right? So you say, okay, well, we're going to take 1.65. Well, first of all, you're going to have to keep getting maternity leaves and so on, which is just going to raise my taxes. You keep getting these maternity leaves, but if you want to go back to work quickly, it just means that we're going to take at least half your salary and dump it in daycare. So your 1.65 million, 150 times 11 years, well, it's all pre-tax and all of that, right? So that's a mirage. You're not bringing 150K a year to the table. It's a mirage. It has no meaning, no value to me, because it doesn't exist. The best case scenario is strangers raise my children and you end up bringing home about 15 bucks an hour after all expenses, right? Second car, lunches out, commuting, clothing, dry cleaning, daycare, stress, problems. Oh, and then, you know, when my parents and your parents age, we then got to pay for all of that because you're not available to take care of them as they age. So the woman says, I come with 150 grand to the table of this. And the man, because he's an intelligent man that she wants and is good at negotiating, says, no, you don't. Not if I want kids. If you don't want kids, who cares, right? Whatever. I mean, that's just weirdos who don't want kids. They're just very damaged and bizarre people who don't want kids. And I'm sorry, but it's true. So the woman says, I'm coming with 150K. That's leverage. And it's like, but it's not, because it's a mirage. It's not real. And we know that. Men know that. You know, you don't become successful without being able to do basic math, right? Ah, crazy. Now, of course, if it's a female who's a teacher or whatever, that's different because she gets summers off and that helps a lot as well. But yeah, it's just, I mean, I've worked in a daycare, man. I know what it's like in there. I know what it's like. It's chaos. It's absolute chaos. All you're doing is prying children off, thumping each other with snotty blocks of Lego. You're not actually really teaching any virtues or values or deferral of gratification or patience or politeness or consideration or thoughtfulness or courage or anything like that. So women want men who are very good at negotiating, and then they bring these men a terrible deal and wonder why he just goes to another woman. Or, God forbid, you know how this goes. Sorry, I'll shut up in a second. You know how this goes. A woman in her 30s who's panicking about her TikTok clock, she says to the man, well, I'm bringing $150,000 to the table. We're going to be a power couple. We're going to build an empire, blah, 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 right? Well, you're going to stay home, raise the kids. Or you don't stay home and raise the kids, in which case you're doing some weird cyborg nipple suck in a corporate toilet and throwing stuff in the fridge, which is just weird and bizarre and not what children need. Or my kids are going to grow up sickly because they don't have good immune system boosts from breast milk and all of the protective elements, both for brain growth and all of that and immune system growth. I'm not going to get any of that because they're going to be on cocaine snow powder space formula from another galaxy. And so the women say, well, I'm 35. I make $150,000 a year. You should marry me. And he's like, well, the $150,000 a year is mostly a mirage, unless I want other people to raise my kids, in which case, what's the point of having them? So let's see. There's a 25-year-old. She's only got a little bit of debt. She's happy to stay home. She's got some trad wife brain virus that's clearing out the rubble of feminism. And so, yeah, that's good. And the woman says, but I'm a professional. And he says, but she can give me 4 kids. I'm lucky to get 1 with you. And your income is largely mirage. So I'm going to go with the younger woman. And then the women in their mid-30s, but the women in mid-30s turn totally feral. Well, that age gap is inappropriate. It's halfway to pedo planets and so on, right? Because it's kind of tough. A woman's value to a high-value man is her fertility and her willingness to serve the family, because he's serving the family 10 hours a day, 12 hours a day by working and providing resources. Her fertility and her willingness to serve equally the family. And if the moment she says unpaid labor, I mean, I remember that, man. I tend to go on dates with these women. They talk about the wage gap. And, you know, I'm fine with that. You know, talk about the wage gap. People are programmed and propagandized. So I disabused them of the wage gap. And then if they ever brought up unpaid labor, women's unpaid labor, I'd be like, no, you're just a resentful ulcer that is just going to make my life hell. And again, the moment that my wife is like thrilled to serve a family, as I'm thrilled to serve a family, and that she's willing to do things that are helpful to me, as I love doing things that are helpful to her, mostly by staying out of the way in the kitchen. But then it's a beautiful thing. You know, I feel like we accidentally tripped over like this perfect union of historical compatibility. And it's a beautiful thing, man. It's a beautiful thing. You know, because one of the things I hate about communists, I mean, there's many things. Communism kills like 4 to 5 times the number of men than it kills women. So women who are voting left are dragging you to a freaking gulag. Like, I'm not kidding. Do not break bread with people who want you gulagged. But what communists do is they imagine that you can, through propaganda, ideology, and programmed language, you can undo billions of years of evolution. You know, we'll have people in an economic system who don't respond to incentives and aren't motivated by profit. See, profit is not money. Profit is calories. Any creature that wasn't even remotely interested in consuming more calories than the creature expended died. The most fundamental profit loss is not money, it's calories, right? If you expend 2,000 calories and you only take in 1,500 calories, you're going to die. So profit is, so all of life, or 4 billion years, all of life is founded upon responding to incentives and maximizing profit. And then it's turned with the free market to economically productive win-win negotiations. But the idea that, well, I've got some ideology and a big old beard, I've got canker sores, and I bang my maid and then toss her out when she gets pregnant after complaining that capitalists exploit the working class, aka I'm Karl Marx, and I'm going to overturn 4 billion years of evolution with my carbuncles and my dusty room at the British Museum, even though I overturned the theory, labor theory of value in my last book. My ideology can completely overturn all of evolution and everything that motivates people. It's like having an ideology that requires no sex drive among people. I mean, that's just not a possibility. It's not a real thing. And I don't know why people fall for this kind of, you have to build your systems from what life is and what people are. You can't just, I mean, Christianity does the same thing in some ways. I'm not comparing it directly, of course, to Marxism, but Christianity says, well, what if we cared for everyone as much as we care for our own children? And it's like, you know, that's not a thing, right? And if it was a thing, we never would have survived as a species. You have to have genetic in-group preference, starting with your family. But what if we didn't? What if there was no genetic in-group preference? Then we wouldn't be here. Jesus. Anyway, all right. Thank you for your questions and comments. I hope that helped. And I'd like to thank everyone who's dropping by here. We have not heard from Richard in a little while. Richard, I've done a fair amount of work today, so I'm going to keep this relatively brief, this next part, but if you'd like to tell me what's on your mind, I'd be happy to hear.
Hey, Stefan. Can you hear me?
Go ahead. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, how are you doing?
Good, thanks.
Yeah, okay, that's great. So, I just have a quick comment to make before I ask my question about your meeting your wife. That wonderful moment when you had your sandals picked up, which was so awesome. And I was thinking about, like, you know, the what reciprocity does for a couple when you have this this idea of, like, the sum of your parts as a family is so much greater sorry, you know, the value in your family is so much greater than the sum of its parts. And you can't put a measure to that, I don't think. And that is so wonderful and so awesome. And, you know, I think, you know, people need to kind of hear that out there, that, you know, when you meet this person, whether you're a man or a woman, don't pass up on that, you know, don't pass up on that opportunity. Take it. And you took that opportunity, and, you know, that you had this incredible moment of like, wow, you know, like I've met this woman and she's willing to pick up my sandals. Like, wow, what an amazing thing. And then look what grew out of that. It's just an incredible thing, isn't it? You know, that your whole future changed as of that moment. And that is just amazing, like an amazing thing to happen. And anyway, I just wanted to make that comment on that you brought up. The other thing I wanted to talk about was, I haven't called in for a while because I've been so damn busy, like 24 hours a day, and I haven't really had the time to call in. But I am now have a little bit more time. I want to make a mention to the number of call-ins you get when it seems to me people get trapped by their dysfunctional parents, whatever the history is. And some of them are just truly just horrific. You know, it's a spectrum, really, because, you know, on the different. Okay, so it's not so much a question as a comment, but I think that people need to be aware that they don't surrender their agency to sentimentality for their parents. And what I mean by this is that you can become a hostage to your parents, and therefore you surrender your agency in the present. And I just want to know what your opinion on that observation is.
So you mean because people feel endlessly obligated to their parents, no matter what, that they don't have free will in their choices?
Well, they still have free will, but they surrender that.
Well, I mean, but if you surrender it, you don't have it. I can't say, have a cake and I've given it away, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So they surrender their free will in honor of their sentimentality or their obligation to their parents, and then they forfeit their futures.
Yeah, no, it's very true and it's very sad. So it is bad people who create categories that you're obligated to rather than virtues you should respond to. So parents, and I'm not talking about all parents, but I would say the majority, certainly around the world, most. So parents create this category called mother and father, but I'm your mother, but I'm your father, right? And they create this category that you owe allegiance to. Governments do this with countries, as if the country is the government. Country is usually the opposite of the government, because culture is that which is chosen, government is that which is imposed. So bad people create categories, and they say, you owe allegiance to this category, mother, father, or whatever, right? Could be priest, could be teacher, could be anything, right? So I there's this category you owe allegiance to. I am in that category, therefore you owe allegiance to me. And I think that's terrible. It would be like me saying, there's a category called philosopher that's always right. I am a philosopher, therefore I'm always right. I mean, that would be a crazy and dysfunctional and wrong thing to say. I mean, I'm not always right. Mostly, but not always. So everything needs to be earned individually. Love is our emotional response to virtue if we're virtuous and we can't will it. Like, you can't will yourself to become more slender if you want to lose weight. You can only change your diet and exercise and so on, right? You can't just will it out of nowhere. You can will the behaviors that manifest in less weight on you, but you can't will directly less weight on you. You can't will love. You can manifest the behaviors that would be worthy of love, you know, moral courage, honesty, integrity, and other various virtues, and affection, and hopefully a sense of fun and good humor and so on. But yeah, evildoers will always create categories. Like, the presidency of the United States is worthy of respect no matter who's in there. Well, I'm your teacher. I'm obey the teacher, right? That's what your parents say. You listen to your teacher, obey your teacher. It's like, well, how about the teacher earns my compliance or submission or acceptance or deference or respect? How about the individual earns it? Well, people who can't earn that respect, they want the socialist subsidy of the category. That you have to respect the office, you have to respect the law, you have to respect the presidency, you have to respect the parent, you have to respect the teacher or the priest. No, I don't have to do any of that. In fact, none of it. I judge my parents as people. I do not judge them as parents. Now, of course, I'll give them more consideration because they are my parents. I will give them more chances to redeem themselves. I mean, if I met my mom at some dinner party, I would be like, whoa, like I'm not never going to talk to that person again. So I had a couple of conversations with her out of consideration for her being my mother and so on, right? But fundamentally, a father doesn't jump off a cliff and say, I'm immune from gravity because I'm a father, splat, right? I mean, parents are subject to math, physics, electromagnetism. They're subject to condensation, the requirements for food and water and shelter, and so on. They need a heartbeat to live, and so on, right? So parents are subject to all the natural laws of the universe, and they're as subject to moral judgments as surely as they're subjected to physical laws. And every time I come across someone who says, you owe me respect, deference, resources, and so on because of a category, like the poor, right? The poor. Well, you got to help the poor. It's like, well, people are more than just four letters and two legs, as I talk about in my novel, Just Poor, which you should absolutely get a copy of. The audiobook is fantastic in particular, freedomain.com/books. But I really dislike anybody who tries to tell me, well, he's your brother, she's your sister, it's your aunt. Like, I don't care. I care whether they're good people. I care whether they're moral people. And in particular, when parents say, you have to lower your standards of morality and have respect for me as a category, right? It should be, thou shalt honor thy good mother and thy good father. And true, yes, absolutely. We honor virtuous and good people. It's a wonderful thing to do. But not, thou honor thy mother and thy father as categories. Because the moment somebody comes along and says, you must honor the category rather than the individual, I know there's a corrupt individual in there who's bringing this cloak of category around him and pretending that that's what you ought to give respect to rather than that which is earned by the individual. I mean, if I say Elon Musk, nobody owes me $1 trillion, right? The category is not the person. And so I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing I wanted to add to that was that for all of us, time is running out all the time, you know? So for men, I'm speaking for women too, but for especially for men who, you know, get entrapped by this category of they have to show deference to their parents, regardless of what their parents have done to them in the past, good or bad, they're... your time is running out, and you either recognize that or you just continue in this sort of hostage situation, and you need to wake up to that fact and realize that your life has value as well as just your parents' value.
Well, and sorry, let me just mention as well, because I do understand hypergamy, I will be nothing but the master in my own home. I understand how women work. I understand how children work. I was a child, and I've written some pretty good female characters over the course of my career as a fiction writer. I know how women work. And when I say I wish to be nothing less than the master in my own home, I don't mean that I rule. I mean, my wife has her areas of expertise and specialty where her authority goes unquestioned. But I will not have anyone in my life who does not treat me with the respect I deserve. I don't care if Jesus himself comes down in a path of exploding kitten petals. If Jesus were to not treat me with the respect that I deserve, he would not be welcome in my house. Now, of course, I understand that's a little blasphemous, so I'm just using it for effect. But I have never let my wife see me dominated by another person. When I've had people come up to me who are mad at me because of what I do, and they confront me and so on, I will stand my ground. Yeah. I will not let my wife or my daughter see me defer to others. I mean, I defer to reason and evidence, of course, right? And if they bring reason and evidence, and, you know, I came back on X Twitter because my daughter had a great argument and I couldn't obviously overturn that argument. So, but I do not. So my mother and my father did not treat me with the respect that I deserved. And I tried to reason with them and I tried to talk to them about it. And other family members, close family members, did not treat me with the respect I deserved. Like my friend I talked about earlier who kept putting me down in company, just did not treat me with the respect I deserve. So, yeah, I just, and I'll reason with the person and say, this is not what I like, this is not what I want. But life is, if you've earned self-respect and if you've earned the respect of others, they owe it to you. In the same way that if you've worked all week at some place, they owe you the paycheck. And I owe respect to people who've earned it as well. It is a bill that it is honorable to pay and dishonorable to withhold. And if you want to be successful, I'm just talking about it from the male perspective, but if you want to be successful as a man, you have to act in ways in which you respect yourself, and you cannot, in particular, in front of your wife and children, you cannot permit yourself to be treated with disrespect. And so if somebody comes over and is kind of putting you down or doesn't listen or doesn't respect your reasonable authority and so on, then you can talk to them about it. You know, talked about it with them. I go with the biblical thing. I'll usually talk about it three times with someone. And if they won't change, my future means infinitely more to me than my past. My parents, my family of origin, they were my unchosen past. My wife, my daughter, they are my chosen future, present and future. And anybody who sacrifices that which they can choose for the better, for that which they never chose for the worst, and anybody who's willing to burn up the future in return for compliance with a broken history, unfortunately deserves all of the losses that accumulate to them. And of course, I could not have ever married my wife if my family of origin was still in my life. Because, I mean, as you probably know, my wife practiced psychology for over a quarter century. She's very well versed in these things. And if I had a dysfunctional family in my life, she wouldn't have, I mean, she would have said, hey, you're a great guy, you're a fun guy, but I'm not marrying into that. And the idea that I would have ended up wiping my crazy mom's butt rather than having a life of love and laughter with my wife is depressing beyond words. So I strongly urge people, act in ways that you can self-respect and do not have people in your life who do not treat you with respect. It will eat your future and burn you to the ground. freedomain.com/donate. Thank you so much, my friends, for a lovely evening of philosophy and conversation. If you could help out the show, I really, really would appreciate it. You can, of course, book a public or private call with me, call.freedomain.com. There's some spots open a little later this week. If you wanted to check that out, shop.freedomain.com and peacefulparenting.com as well. Lots of love, everyone. Thank you so much, as always. Bye-bye.